I'm Jonathan Aberman. Coming up on today's show.
If you look at who makes it, who's successful as an entrepreneur and a business owner, people tend to be, you know, middle-aged and have a good amount of experience and have a backup plan and maybe a spouse who has a job. They're not 22-year-olds who are making, you know, the next new app or becoming, you know, TikTok influencers.
Welcome to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.
As someone who promotes very much the idea of entrepreneurship, doing it yourself and making your own career, I recently read a book which made me think about the very preconceptions I carry. Benjamin Waterhouse is going to join us today to talk about his new book, One Day I'll Work for Myself. And he has some very important things to say about why and how we've gotten to a place in society where entrepreneurship is the answer for everything and may actually be the answer for very little. So here's our conversation. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we were getting ready to go on the air, we shared the experience that we're both business owners, you know, around business, grow up around businesses. What drove you as somebody who's been around small business to write a book that, you know, frankly, is titled The Dream and Delusion of Small Business? It's so a little bit counterintuitive.
Yeah. Well, what drove me to this is I'm a historian. I'm a historian of American business, politics, and culture, and particularly where those things intersect with each other. And I've been for 20 years studying American political economy and the history of capitalism and the role of businesses in American life, particularly in modern America, you know, 1960s forward. And after spending a lot of time writing about large corporations and large lobbyists and things like that, I was increasingly persuaded that there was an important story in the smaller but much more numerous side of the business community, both the small business broadly and the self-employed sector as well. As it happened in the same years, you know, in the last decade or so that I was getting into my historical research, my own family kind of took a turn into business ownership, and my wife is now run a couple of different companies, and the one she's working on at the moment, I happen to be a partner in. I like to say I'm not quite as much of a silent partner as she would probably prefer, but there I am.
I can relate to that. And, you know, in a funny way, I think that every business is a family business, you know, because that's certainly what my experience, you know, my grandparents, one was a tailor, the other one owned a furniture store, and classic, very much the immigrant story, which, by the way, is one of the things you point out in the book, that, you know, mm-hmm. A lot of entrepreneurs become entrepreneurs by necessity. And that was certainly the case with my family coming as they did through Ellis Island. And, you know, growing up with them and then my parents owning their own businesses, the ups and downs and the ins and outs, as you're a child growing up in that business or your spouse, you are in the business, whether you're an owner or not. It very much shapes this good and bad.
That's right. And one of the stories I tell in the middle of the story is the story of my own father, who, while unlike your family, was not coming from an immigrant background, but he had what I think is a very common experience of kind of middle range white collar workers in his mid 40s. And he just said, the heck with this, I'm sick of working for people. He always had a very independent streak to him. And he just was not happy getting up and putting on a coat and tie every day. And so at the age of 45, he came home and said, nope, quit my job. And I'm gonna do this industrial machinery sales business out of the basement of the house. And that's what he did for the rest of his life.
It's interesting to me, and now we'll go a little more into the book, I think, because your research is very, very comprehensive in how we got to where we got to. And there are a number of threads that I think are very interesting in your book. One is this mythology, this idea that I'm just going to one day just stick it to the man and I'm done. I'm going to go work for myself. And that seems, where do you think that comes from? Because it is very much a part of how people think about small business entrepreneurship.
Well, on one hand, and I can say this as a historian, it has really deep roots, right? It has really old, and it's a really old idea that goes all the way back to the sort of ethos that we often associate with the the colonial American period, the founding of the country, people like Thomas Jefferson, who, you know, sort of for all the hypocrisy of his claims about the freeholding yeoman farmer being the kind of font of liberty, you know, really did help cement that idea. And throughout the industrializing period in the 19th century, it still kind of held a really strong grip. So in many cases, I think when people hear that or say that, they're tapping into something very old in the American cultural mentality. At the same time, it's reinforced. Like, these ideas are constantly reinvented for different moments in time and different moments in economic history or technological history. And so we also, I think, need to see this as something that's constantly reinforced, even as times change.
Yeah. So what I have felt and often communicate to my students when I teach entrepreneurship, I point to the colonial times, but I also point to things like Frederick Jackson Turner and the Frontier Thesis, which, for those of our listeners who don't know, his thesis in the late 1800s was that America was going to stop being a dynamic place because it lost the frontier. Right? And in a lot of ways, when I'm a venture investor, what I'm doing is I'm finding people who want to find the new frontier. So it's very hardwired, you know, sort of the cowboy image, the rugged individual. It's all hardwired. But yet by the same token, it seems to me that there's a difference between the desire to be my own boss and a clear understanding of what it actually means to own your own business. And, you know, this is something that you really point out in your book. I was actually struck, I will tell you, by you pointing out that this work at home movement that we see very much as COVID, this is not a new thing.
Yeah, that's right. I was sort of surprised to find this out as well. This was one of the joys of doing historical research, is you learn things that are sort of unexpected. But what I discovered and what I argue in the book is that there was a movement, a work from home movement in the 1980s. And it came on the heels of the kind of creation of the concept of telecommuting, telework, which itself was a product of the oil crisis in the 1970s, when gas prices were suddenly so high and the companies were looking for ways to both decrease the costs as well as maybe a little more of an environmental consciousness about literal commuting in cars. By the 1980s, you combine all that ethos with the fax machine, with cheaper telephone communications. And you really did see this when you combine that environmentalist ethos from the 1970s with, in the 1980s, the proliferation of the fax machine and with much less expensive telecommunications, you get this real strong and palpable desire voiced by a lot of people to relocate the center of work from the company, from the corporate headquarters to the home. And it's not a very big leap of logic to go from working for a regular company from your house to working for yourself as the owner of a home-based business.
And what struck me from your research is that a lot of the promise of this home, working from home productively, I'm going to put it aside from the snake oil salespeople of buy a franchise, work from home, make a lot of money but not do anything. We'll put that aside in a moment. That whole movement, did it come to much? I mean, did it really change the nature of work?
No, I think it actually was sort of a bubble. In a lot of ways, we went back to it, right, during the COVID pandemic. Yep. By necessity, and obviously with even greater telecommunications, things like Zoom, that allowed people to do it. But what happened, I think, in the 80s and early 90s is there was this kind of boomlet of people thinking, oh, wait, well, I can really work from home. There's a pushback from large employers. There are some advantages to having people work from home, and certainly some people continue to do it. But by the 21st century, by the 2000s particularly, you see major employers really pushing back against it, especially in maybe ironically in the tech sector. Huge companies like Google put a lot of time and money into making work a place that you want to be. They make it easier. They have these beautiful campuses, and they have, you know, games and rec rooms and childcare and snacks, all of these things to bring you to the company rather than, I mean, of all places, a tech company might be even at the forefront of having people work from home. And by the you know, 2010s or so, before the pandemic, the trend seemed to be quite the opposite, quite moving away from people working at home and finding out what people can do better if they're all under the same roof together.
Yeah, I remember going to the Google campus years ago, and somebody explaining how googly everything was as they're going along in their scooters and roller skates, and here's the gourmet chef. And I mean, it was just, guys, this is not a place to work. This is Disney World. I mean, it's just, but you know, one thing that's really struck me, and this struck me particularly since I'm an educator, educates people on entrepreneurship, is so many of the examples you give of the people that promoted teleworking, the people that promoted work from home, to be blunt, they're charlatans. They're not actually there were people promoting something that actually wasn't good for the people hearing the message.
Well, you know, that's there's a whole there's a long strain in American business of exactly that, of people who are making their living by trying to convince somebody else about how they should make theirs. And it's usually better, you're better off to be in the first position than the second position. One of the themes of the book is that there are hierarchies and there are power differentials where one group is in a position to take advantage of the other. And I, you know, when I talk about franchises, I point that out. You know, the franchising company tends to do better in that deal than the individual franchisee. Likewise, in the gig economy, you know, the shareholders of Uber are gonna do much better than the individual drivers.
So when we come back after break, since we are What's Working in Washington, let's talk first about how Washington's politicians and political parties actually have created the sense that we all should be working for ourselves. I'm here with Benjamin Waterhouse, author of One Day I'll Work for Myself. We'll be right back. Has a mission, you know that. It's to make us all better informed and to promote DC as a place where we can build great careers and also the challenges we have to overcome. If you want to help, you can do the following things. First, send us your guest suggestions. If you think somebody's interesting, I'll think they're interesting too. Reach out to me through LinkedIn. I'll answer your email. The second thing is, if you like the show, subscribe. There's no better way for us to be able to keep doing this than have our audience grow. Or better yet, tell a friend. Invite a friend to subscribe or just give us a like. It seems like such a simple thing, but you know, it actually makes a difference. So thanks for listening. We're back. I'm here with Benjamin Waterhouse, author of One Day I'll Work for Myself, The Dream and Delusion That Conquered America. Talk to me about, or talk to us about, the role the politicians and lobbyists have played in creating the sense that we all should be small business owners. It's not an accident.
No, you're right. It's not an accident. You know, what the argument that I trace out in the book is that there's a very specific historical timeline to what we now think of as the mythology of self-employment and working for yourself. And it comes out of the 1970s from, you know, to take the long view from the industrial period of the 19th century through into the 20th century and the World War II period and afterwards. That was the rise of big businesses. That was the rise of large corporations, particularly by the post-war period, 1950s, 1960s. In the 1970s, the American economy was in a bad way. It was in a stagnating funk, and there was a lot of, you know, kind of hand-wringing about how do we recover this lost growth. And a number of political figures from a range of ideological perspectives, different political parties, kind of coalesced around the idea that it was going to be encouraging small business broadly, but particularly entrepreneurial business startups that was going to revive the business, that the old kind of corporate dinosaurs of the post-war period, these giant extractive companies, these large service providing companies were stagnant and that they weren't going to generate the kind of growth that was needed. So politicians jump on this because, of course, as we were saying before the break, the notion of independent work, working for yourself, this goes way back in American culture. And so no politician will ever get any, you know, bad backlash for hailing the virtues of the little guy. At the same time, there's lobbying organizations and think tanks and business school professors and the sort of intellectual movement as well, all of which says, you know, we need to find a way to encourage more people to go into business, to take risk, to put money into new ideas. And it's going to be really growing the economy from the bottom up. That's how we're going to recover the kind of lost growth that we were experiencing in the 1970s. And even in, particularly into the 1980s, when you know, deindustrialization continues apace, factories are closing, work is disappearing in major parts of the country.
So I find it really, and I'm very much taken by, and you revealed this early in the interview, you're a historian who studies basically capitalism's economic structures. And it, to me, it's very significant that we're moving towards this idea of sort of an economy where it's sort of every man and woman for themselves. We must teach people how to fend for themselves. And I wonder, and I wonder this honestly as an educator, is it really true that everybody is best suited in a world where it's everybody for themselves? I mean, some people shouldn't be entrepreneurs.
Right. I mean, I think you're exactly right. It's not for everyone. And I think you hear this from people who are lifelong entrepreneurs. It's almost always the first thing I hear out of people's mouths is this isn't for everybody. This life is difficult. It's uncertain. There's a lot of risk involved. There's a lot of, you know, sleepless nights and so forth. It's also the case that not every sector of the economy lends itself to independent work in exactly the same way. And, you know, so the question becomes what type of work are you capable of doing and are you trained to do? And is that the kind of work that benefits from, say, the economies of scale that come from working in a large corporation? Or is it something that can be done as effectively on your own? And, you know, those answers vary quite a bit. There's no kind of one size fits all here.
No, there's not. And I will say that as somebody who helped start companies, technology companies in particular, there is a role to play in our economy for entrepreneurs who are willing to take significant risks to commercialize and create new things. But I think what's missing is this, and now having read your book, I think I can understand why there's this one size fits all view that is this something that we all should do. And I'm, to be blunt, I feel like it's a bit exploitive. You know, in a way, yeah, because it seems a bit predatory as I read a lot of the things in your book that some of the people are screaming the loudest, oh, we should all be entrepreneurs, the ones that frankly benefit from either not having well-capitalized competitors or having a lot of people who are willing to work without benefits.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the big picture, what you're doing is you're outsourcing the responsibility for people's welfare onto the individual people. You're sort of taking what either the corporation or the society at large could be accountable for and putting that on the shoulders of the worker slash business owner slash entrepreneur, whether that's healthcare or childcare or education or any other of these benefits, not to mention the, you know, the straight up, you know, the perks of employment and income itself.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. As you prepared this, as you wrote this book and as you researched it, you mentioned earlier that the telework movement from the 80s that had existed surprised you. What else surprised you about your research?
I think I was surprised by the story of the business schools and the degree to which you know, there's really a pronounced movement, and it's very easy to find in time. There's almost no entrepreneurship courses taught in America's business schools until the early 1970s, a handful. Mm-hmm. And then between the mid 1970s to about 1990 or so, these numbers just explode, and then they keep exploding. So the amount of kind of intellectual effort and capital that was being poured into these ideas expands alongside the business school itself, and business school becomes the place where very ambitious and intelligent young people decide that this is where they're going to be trained to be, you know, to be very well, high succeeding people. And I think it was in this moment that business schools shifted primarily from training people to be administrators, right? From the master of business administration to focusing quite a bit more on entrepreneurship, on finance and things like that, which have sort of come to dominate the business world in the last 40 years or so.
Yeah. So I've been in the middle of that. I've been teaching entrepreneurship in a university setting. I was a dean of a business school, and you're absolutely right. It's the trend that basically ate business education. And my rationale and how I've approached it, for what it's worth, is I think that Silicon Valley, in a lot of ways, has, you know, we talk about promoters and self-interested promoters of an ideal. Silicon Valley is in the business of creating technology product companies, and Stanford's in the middle of this ecosystem. And so there is a sense that the only entrepreneurship that really is relevant in our society is, let's start a company, get investors, and let's grow the next Google. And it's created this sort of this, I'll call it almost, you know, your book points out all that work at home to become rich. In a lot of ways, venture capital and the mythology is start a company to get rich. And right. the way I decided to approach it as an educator, and the way I try to talk about it is the point of studying entrepreneurship is not to do a startup. It's to teach you how to think strategically, how to do something that's highly relevant to others so you can make a living.
Right.
Which, and I think that's the part that misses. So I have a relative who came to me a couple of days ago with a get rich quick scheme, which was use my system and you use AI. And I said, it never explains how you're going to make money. And throughout your book, it's apparent all these people that are promoting work from home never actually explain how you make money doing it. They just talk about lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And I think, you know, one of the dirty little secrets here is that there's only a certain number of ways that you can actually be profitable in the business world. And generally speaking, it's by, you know, taking advantage of some inefficiency in the system or some discrepancy between, non-competitive markets or some difference that you're able to take advantage of and do something better. And, you know, if you can't do something better, if you're just doing the same old thing, then the best you can probably hope for is to kind of break even and make the same amount of money as a business owner as you would working for somebody else. And for some people, that's fine, right? Some people say, okay, I'd rather work on my own schedule and take that kind of personal risk, but have the rewards that come from the freedom of control over my own time and so forth, and simply make a living. And there's some interesting anthropological research about people who are, you know, sort of self-employed, non-employer firms, right? They're themselves, like they're freelancers of one sort or another. And they're, you know, among this kind of culture, their idea is simply to get by, to make a living. And they're not trying to become millionaires and retire at 30. They work in the trades, or they're artists, or they're, you know, various types of work that people do. And that's great. I think that's actually, you know, a really nice way to approach life. If you're in a position where you're not being exploited, it's the idea that, like, I'm going to go into business for myself, selling, you know, dietary supplements out of my garage, and suddenly I'm going to become fabulously wealthy.
So years ago, I was a corporate lawyer as a managing partner of East Coast operations for a big firm. And I decided that I wanted to start my own business. The business is going to be venture capital. I'm going to start my own fund. And a very close friend of mine, a successful entrepreneur, sat down with me and said, why do you want to do this? And I thought it was a trick question, to tell you the truth. I looked at him and I said, well, I want to do this because I want to get rich. And his answer was, if you want to get rich, don't become an entrepreneur. Become an entrepreneur because you like the journey, because it's going to make you feel good as a person to be in charge of your own life. And just try to your point, Ben, just try to break, if you can break even, but don't do it to become rich. And it was phenomenal advice, because I've been at this now working for myself in different ways for well over 20 years now. And it is who I am, and it does make me happy. I want everybody to read this book, but I also want them to be critical and say to yourself, fundamentally, am I doing this because it's going to make me happy?
Yeah, and I think that's a great kind of, those are good words to live by. I think that that's a healthy way to do it. And really what I, my hope with this book is that people will, you know, first understand a little bit of a why we think the things that we do and question some of these seemingly unquestionable assumptions. And then, yeah, ask themselves, you know, real probing hard questions about why they're trying to do this. And some of the data that comes out in this book is really quite telling. If you look at who makes it, who's successful as an entrepreneur and a business owner, people tend to be, you know, middle-aged and have a good amount of experience and have a backup plan and maybe a spouse who has a job. They're not 22-year-olds who are making, you know, the next new app or becoming, you know, TikTok influencers.
So that is exactly what I was getting at earlier, the Silicon Valley mythology. The reality is that for most people, the best time to be an entrepreneur is when you know how to do something.
Yeah, that's right.
So, Ben, it was great having you with me today. I very much enjoyed it. I guess the bottom line here is you're not telling people not to be entrepreneurial, are you?
No, not in the least. I do think that it can be used as a political smokescreen, as we said before, to kind of offload responsibility from society in general or from companies onto individuals. And I find that to be really troubling and exploitative. But I don't think on an individual level, I don't think there's a one size fits all way to go.
Well, I really appreciate you being here. The audience, I'm sure, learned a lot today. Make sure you check out Benjamin Waterhouse's book, One Day I'll Work for Myself, The Dream and Delusion That Conquered America. But I'm not disillusioned with this conversation, Ben. I'm inspired. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
What's working in Washington? That's a question we often hear. The reality is, Washington works every day at looking at the issues that have to be addressed, solving problems when we can, but more than anything, the crossroads for where change will occur and needs to occur. This show, What's Working in Washington, brings voices into the studio so you can hear from them what they want to do and how they want to contribute to this great enterprise we call the United States of America. This program is brought to you in partnership with George Mason University's Center for Regional Analysis. The CRA is the region's leading voice in economic data and forecasting. Check out their work at cra.gmu.edu. What's Working in Washington is a team effort. We have a great team. Tracy Madigan is our executive producer and editor. Laura Latendresse is our digital producer. The theme music you've been listening to is performed by the Sunbathers. And thanks to all of you for joining us on What's Working in Washington.
You've been listening to What's Working in Washington on Federal News Network and streaming as a podcast.